Thank you so much. And I'm going to leave about 10 or 15 minutes at the end, but feel free if you have a burning question you want to ask me before we get to the end to, speak up and let me know. So I do want to talk about ethical mistakes in public health despite good intentions. The folks who work in public health are my friends and do some wonderful things. And in fact, there are many, many great successes that public health have had in this last century. Some of them happened right here in Pittsburgh with the polio vaccine, for example. Control of infectious diseases. You need look no further than what happened with Ebola, and we now have a vaccine. Safer workplaces, dramatic improvements in motor vehicle safety. Heart disease has been dramatically reduced over the last half century. Food safety, maternal and infant health, dental health, and tobacco control. All of those are good examples of great success in public health. And yet, ethical lapses do occur. And this quote from George Santayana is particularly apt, and he's the guy who brought us the words that if people who forget history are doomed to repeat it. He has lots of good little aphorisms, but fanaticism comes when people are so convinced that what they're doing is right that they double down on their efforts when they forget what their original goal was and what they're doing, and it can take you to a pretty dark place. So we're going to talk about four case studies of lapses that have occurred. Some of these are probably familiar to you. The poisoning of alcohol. Eugenics, and we have an expert on eugenics in the room, so I'm a little bit intimidated. But and then also the war on obesity. I'll start with alcohol poisoning in Prohibition. And here I'm not talking about what we call a diagnosis of alcohol poisoning, where you drink too much alcohol and you get sick or can be killed by it. In fact, this is about putting poison in alcohol to deter people from drinking it. Now, the Prohibition movement came after the success in the elimination of slavery. It was led by Protestant pietists and social progressives, and it was really a serious social problem during the Industrial Revolution. So it was a worthy cause. It was really important to try to deal with the impact that alcohol was having. Prohibition was enacted by a constitutional amendment, you guys probably know this, in 1919. It was repealed in 1933, and it did a whole lot of good things. In some ways, alcohol consumption didn't disappear, as we all know, but it did go down pretty dramatically. Diagnosis of liver cirrhosis went down during Prohibition, and that was a fairly dramatic thing. Alcoholic psychosis went down, and there were a lot of admissions for alcoholic psychosis to mental institutions at the time. Public drunkenness was less of a problem. Absenteeism from work was less of a problem. So it's not as if Prohibition accomplished nothing that was good. However, it also, by a direct consequence of government action, killed about 10,000 people during Prohibition. People, as I think we all sort of know through an understanding of history, people didn't stop drinking altogether. They found ways to get alcohol during Prohibition. And industrial alcohol was an important source of alcohol for speakeasies and other sort of places where people got their alcohol. And the government was mightily frustrated by that, and they said, well, here's what we can do. We can put methanol in the alcohol and poison it so that people will know that if they drink this alcohol that's not really legal now, it will hurt them. And that'll stop them. Well, it didn't. people started showing up in hospitals with poisoning from the methanol. And when that happened, government regulators and government health officials, and this was the federal government at work, said, gosh, maybe we need to put more of this poison in there. And so they upped the levels of methanol, and they started experimenting with some really nasty stuff. Benzene, mercury, and other things. In the end, it was approximately 10,000 people who were killed by this effort to deter people from drinking. At the time, people knew this was going on, and it was hotly debated. Okay, there was a lot of denial. Folks who thought that was a good idea said, "Well, no, that's not the additives to the industrial alcohol that's killing all these people. That is excessive drinking. It can't, you know, that's not our fault." Or, well, they rationalized it by saying, "These people should not be drinking. It's against the law. They're getting what they deserve." And then finally, there was a lot of controversy, as evidenced by these headlines. And you'll see there a Pittsburgh connection in Mr. Mellon holding out the hope of finding a way to have a harmless additive to alcohol that they could keep adding to deter people from drinking without exactly killing them. That didn't really work out. Ultimately, prohibition lost support of the public. It lost support of the public for a lot of reasons. All of these people being killed was one of them, but there were other unintended consequences. There was the rise of organized crime. There was the economic hardships that it created for the businesses, that hospitality businesses. It took a very serious hit during that time. Perhaps as important as anything was that as we went into the Depression and governments needed the revenues that came from taxes on alcohol, they found themselves hurting very badly because of prohibition. And so attitudes started to change. It was repealed in 1933, but some of the effects of that, some of the distrust that sowed, still linger today. We have this letter that was written by John D. Rockefeller Jr. After Prohibition, and he was quite a fan of it going in, and he basically said, you know, I had hoped that the public would embrace this. I hoped that they would see the evil of alcohol and everybody could get behind it and it would work out just great, but in fact, I have to admit that hasn't worked out at all. Drinking has gone up. Speakeasies have risen as a result of this, and that's not been a positive force for us. And there's a vast army of lawbreakers that have come forward. Some of the most conscientious citizens among us have totally ignored prohibition, and respect for the law has gone down in a dramatic way. And we've seen crime rise in unacceptable ways. So this was a good idea that I supported, and it just didn't work out. So there's one example of good intentions sort of run amok. Now, how many people are familiar with the Tuskegee experiment? Okay, so we've got some good awareness. This is something that, you know, we are a white, suburban, comfortable church. This is something that really is huge in the African American community. And when you think about the facts of this situation, it you can understand why it looms large. This is an infamous experiment, and clearly wholly unethical, that began in 1932. It was conducted by the U.S. Public Health Service. The objective was to study the natural history of untreated syphilis, to know, you know, just what exactly is going on there. You know, kind of academically, an interesting idea, and uh, it involved 600 impoverished black sharecroppers from Alabama. Close to 400 of them had syphilis at the outset of the study. Those are the facts of the study. The problems with the study are really all about deception and mistreatment of these subjects who, it's hard to look at this study and think anything other than that they were considered as somehow less than human. They were told that the study would last only 6 months. In fact, the study lasted 40 years. Their diagnosis of syphilis, these nurses and public health people knew that they had syphilis, and they concealed it from these individuals for 40 years. 40 years. And they withheld treatment. Now, this is particularly ironic. On the right, on this slide, you see a public health poster about the urgency of treating syphilis early. And at the same time you're sending out public health messages about that, we have these 600 poor black individuals from Alabama who were illiterate being kept from knowing that they had syphilis and being kept from having treatment. It's hard to think of a more dramatic example of unethical behavior. But somehow these investigators were able to rationalize what they were doing based upon biases that they held about the sexual behavior of African Americans. These are, you can see in the notes and the correspondence of these people, these are people who were regarded as acting like animals when it came to sex. And so it just somehow escaped the thinking of the people involved with the study that what they were doing is wrong. The subjects were blamed for having the disease. They had the disease through misdeeds, so it really didn't feel so bad to treat them so badly in this study. Now, you get into the 60s after the study's been going on for about 30 years, and people started dawning on people that this is wrong, a few people. A young doctor just 4 years out of medical school, here he is in a picture closer to retirement, his name was Erwin Schatz, kind of stood up just 4 years out of medical school. He read a study that they, a paper that they published based on this study in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and he said, I can't believe they're really doing this. And he wrote to the investigators and said, this is outrageous. How can you justify the ethics of this study? The investigators got the letter, read it, and said, we're not going to respond to this. Stuck it in a file. 2 years, a year later, Peter Buxton raised objections from within the Department of Health and Human Services. And his objections were ignored. He was in the sexually transmitted diseases group at HHS. William Carter Jenkins, an African-American statistician, got wind of what was going on, and he was at HHS, and he raised objections in 68. His objections were ignored. The study just marched on, even in the face of objections, until 1970, when Buxton came back and took his story to the news media, and it became a big scandal. And then within 2 years, the study was stopped. And that's what it took. But it's an understatement to say that the repercussions are lasting. Okay, there is a huge distrust of public health in the African American community as a result of this. A very strong reluctance to participate in clinical research. And there are lots of examples of this. If you happen to listen to the podcast Hidden Brain, there's a study that was just recently done that showed that in a completely randomized fashion, that if an African American man is randomly assigned to see a white or an African American doctor, he will not accept the recommendations of a white doctor, and it's an 80% difference versus if he's assigned to see an African-American doctor. That's how strong, and what are we? We're about 50 years since this study's been stopped, but that's how strong the harm, that broken trust is. Trust, it said, is very hard to build and very easy to break. You can do 50 things right and do one thing wrong and lose trust and lose it forever. So that would be the Tuskegee experiment. Any questions so far? Y'all are being so...
It just occurred to me, we have I'm a regular blood donor, and there's been a lot of appeals for blood donations, but the African-American community, from what I understand, I don't know the exact statistics, is underrepresented in blood donations, which is perhaps an outcome of this as well.
Underrepresented there, underrepresented in clinical trials. When HIV was a problem, there was a reluctance for testing. There was also suspicion that HIV was something that was done by the government to that community. There was also suspicion about the treatments that came for HIV. Were they legitimate for African American people? Strong reluctance. That distrust just really, really lingers. Anybody? Yeah. Well, there was a whole team of investigators. Yeah. The question was, did they ever determine who was actually responsible for continuing the study? And so there were individual investigators and folks leading the study who received the correspondence, but it was more than one individual who was okay with it. It wasn't just somebody secretly hatching this plot. There were folks who, you know, to conduct a 40-year study of 600 people takes a whole lot of resource. And so, you know, one person acting alone couldn't foist that on people. But the problem is is the human power for rationalization. Psychologists have studied this over and over again. It's called motivated reasoning. If you think that your cause is good, well, then the means justify the end, and you can kind of make anything feel okay in the right circumstances. I know Charlotte probably has rafts of examples of where this can be true. The only good news out of this is that as a result of that study, medical ethics really were dramatically beefed up, and it would be very hard to get away with that kind of thing today. We haven't abolished human rationalization, but we have made it harder to do that kind of abuse in a clinical study setting. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Well, eugenics is something that I always associate with the Nazis using it to justify the Holocaust. But as a matter of fact, this was a movement that started in the United States, and it was a whole rationale of controlled breeding to improve the human race. The American Eugenics Society promoted it, state fairs and all over the country, the idea of controlled breeding for a better human race, fitter families, and wanting your children to be thoroughbreds. It really gained momentum after the 1921 International Conference on Eugenics. That's the logo for that here. And here's some examples of materials that the American Eugenics Society took to state fairs, talking about fit and unfit marriages, and asking, if we breed our livestock to be stronger and better, why are we going to let our own children not be so fit? And they talk about unfit human traits, such as feeble-mindedness, epilepsy, criminality. And the whole idea was, you know, through eugenics, their proposition was that you could breed that out of the human race. Well, that eugenics movement internationally kind of faded out after the Nazis, you know, made it look as bad as they did. But the North Carolina Eugenics Board, which was set up in the 30s, initially focusing on people in mental hospitals and reform schools, got new life in the 50s by focusing on welfare recipients. And in the course of its existence, they were responsible for legally mandated involuntary sterilizations for more than 7,000 women. It was rationalized as a social service. There was a Human Betterment League in North Carolina that was funded by wealthy donors such as the Reynolds and other, you know, magnates of the era. And they sold it in nice brochures that talked about North Carolina offering its citizens protection in the form of selective sterilization. They say that the job of parenthood is really too much to expect of the feeble-minded, and you know, some folks would argue that in one of the counties, in Mecklenburg County, they were successful in, and this is around Charlotte, they were successful in sterilizing more women than any other county in North Carolina. And the person, Dr. Kuralt, who sort of led that effort, told himself that, told people that he didn't believe that any of these women were sterilized without some sort of consent. But you see here, you know, some of the promotional materials from it. And here you see the case history of one of the persons who was ordered to receive it. The commission kind of wound down after birth control became more widely available. It was beset by legal challenges. It was renamed to a commission in 1973. The governor of North Carolina finally apologized for it in 2002, and it wasn't fully the idea of involuntary sterilization for women was not fully repealed until 2003. And then in 2013, the North Carolina legislature finally repealed the last of the laws that permitted involuntary sterilization. So that was kind of a sad chapter for the state of North Carolina. So the last thing, and you'll have to forgive me for being a little bit of on my hobby horse, because this is a subject that I work on a lot, and feel free to ask lots of questions. But the last subject is the war on obesity, which I will argue has often been a little bit misdirected and turned into a war on people with obesity. And that's because our thinking about obesity tends to get a little bit clouded with two different kinds of bias. And I'll just say up front that odds are that anybody who thinks that they don't have either of these kinds of biases or both is probably not really clear. I will admit that just about everybody, including myself, harbors some of these biases. One is an intellectual bias about the condition itself that favors personal convictions. Well, you know, a classic example is, well, it's just a matter of energy in and energy out. It's just simple math, which scientifically is false, but that's a very popular notion. The way that the body regulates energy balance and storage of energy for the next famine is actually quite complex. And then there's the bias that is directed at people with obesity. And if you spend time with people who are living with substantial obesity, you know, and you're a good listener, you will know that just navigating life, they are subjected to incredible abuse, even to the extent of absolute strangers throwing fast food wrappers at them to say, you know, this is what you've done to yourself. And to talk a little bit about this bias about obesity and people with obesity, I'll say that people typically view, and you know, I know this from research I've done, I know this from research that's in the literature, that the most common presumption is that obesity is the simple and obvious and inevitable result of bad personal choices. And so, you know, you have three things that contribute to obesity: environment, choices, and genes. And typically people put those personal choices at the top. And in fact, here's a survey that I did back in 2013 where I asked people to choose, you know, is what kind of problem is this? Is this a problem of bad personal choices? Is it a problem of community? Is it a community problem of bad food and few opportunities for exercise? Is it a medical problem? Or is it just something else altogether? And you see that roughly half of the public thinks, oh, well, this is just a personal problem, bad choices. People continue to track it, and in terms of this explicit, you know, this is all your fault, it's declining a little bit. The implicit bias is actually going up. But in fact, it's just the opposite of what people think. Obesity, we know from genetic studies, is clearly a highly heritable condition. 70% of an individual's risk of obesity is based upon the genes that they inherit. Now, the environment triggers those genes to a lesser or greater extent. The question that people ask me typically, or will ask, well, if it's all genetic, have our genes changed that much over the last 30 years to make obesity rates go up? And so the obvious answer to that is no. What's changed is the environment that we live in that does more to trigger the condition. And then, just like any chronic disease, whether you're talking about diabetes, heart disease, or cancer, if you get a chronic disease, you have choices to make, certainly. You have to decide what you're going to do about it. But it's not, nobody steps up and says, please, I'll take this disease. They just get what they've been dealt and then have to figure out how to deal with it. So, as I mentioned, the environment has changed, and there are multiple, people call it a perfect storm of environmental drivers that are pushing us toward ever more obesity. You have labor-saving technology. We spend our days sitting in front of screens more than we ever used to, but it's not just that sitting in front of the screen, it's how do we get to work? How do we walk to the store? How much motion is there routinely in our day? Lots of people have their gym memberships, and that 30 minutes in the gym is helpful, but even more consequential is just the routine movement that's part of your work, that's part of your daily routine, that's part of how you get to the store and so forth. Then you have the food supply, which is altered dramatically. And people debate various factors in the food supply that are driving obesity. The current favorite culprit is sugar-sweetened beverages, and certainly an excess, you know, the 2-liter bottle was probably an evil invention, and as are unlimited refills of sugary beverages, and those are less popular. Consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages has been going down for about a decade because of all of the bad press it's been getting, but that hasn't really reversed the trend. The trends are still going up because there's so many other things in the food supply. The ubiquity of what they call ultra-processed foods that fulfill, if you will, the Lay's potato chip promise. No one can eat just one. There was recently a study done that showed that ultra-processed foods versus whole processed foods in a setting where people were randomized to get food based upon one scheme or the other, people tended to eat more and more calories, and even in a short period of time, gain more weight when they were on a diet purely of ultra-processed foods versus on a diet of whole foods. What they were served was controlled. They could choose how much to eat, and there's something about the physiologic response to those ultra-processed foods that encourages people to eat more and more and more and gain weight. And then finally, you have stress and distress, altered sleep patterns, adverse experience, post-traumatic stress syndrome. All of those things can contribute to the risk of obesity. And drugs and chemicals in the environment. There's something called endocrine-disrupting chemicals, which are present in the pollution from vehicles. They're present in the food supply, things like BPA and other things that leach out of plastic have been shown to actually alter how the body regulates energy storage. Now, why is this so? It is true because we know that we put chemicals into the environment. There's a whole process that the EPA goes through and that chemical manufacturers have to go through to figure out, is it safe for us to bring this chemical into the world? And so what they do is they study it for toxicology. But the studies are designed to figure out, will these chemicals cause cancer? Will laboratory animals wither and die when they are exposed to these chemicals? Nothing in the screen was designed to figure out if it would do just the opposite, but rather cause the animals to prosper and gain weight and grow ever fatter. And so it's very easy for some of these chemicals that we're now suspecting of stimulating weight gain to creep into our environment. And for instance, the CDC tracks the amounts of some of these chemicals that we excrete in our urine. And so they're keeping track of how much BPA we excrete and other things. Chemicals that were used in pizza boxes that have now been banned that alter the alter endocrine function. All of those things come together in a perfect storm to drive the weight of the population up. Susceptible individuals are affected more. There's about 25% of the population that appears to be entirely resistant to weight gain, and they got the lucky gene pool in the current environment. They would be the first people to die in a famine, but what the heck? The environment's working for them right now. Simplistic explanations are invariably wrong, and that's one of the ways that we get it so bad. But these biases about what obesity is kind of get in the way of making progress. When we point the finger at somebody for having excess weight, we tend to create denial and inaction. People avoid doctors. People avoid getting medical care. People avoid that accusation. It's like if you had to get a screen when you went to the ER, did you do anything stupid to get you here? You'd have fewer people making use of the ER. But that's what we tend to do with obesity. So people seek less care, they get poor care, and we also make ineffective policies. And the example that I would offer you is childhood obesity, where the prevalence of severe childhood obesity, and these are children who are large from a very, very early age, they clearly didn't raise their hand and say, I'd like to try out that obesity thing. But that severe childhood obesity is what's growing the most rapidly. And there are about now in the United States 5 million children with severe childhood obesity. And yet, there are only 37 clinics that in any way, shape, or form are prepared to provide adequate medical care for kids with severe childhood obesity. We don't have any in Western Pennsylvania. None. Children's Hospital, where we have a very fine children's hospital, is not set up to really provide care for children with severe obesity. It's not that we don't have them in Western Pennsylvania. I guarantee you that we do. So this comes from a world where we say, you know, this makes my head hurt to think about it. And so what we've got to do is prevent it. Well, 40% of the population already has obesity, so that ship has probably sailed. But that bias still works. The impact on families and youth is great. You have children who are so tormented by bullies, by family members, in education, even in healthcare, that the incidence of suicide is elevated, and you have very visible sort of examples of this. And then you have public service campaigns where, you know, and I'm glad to say that this kind of thing is not happening as much now. This kind of explicit bias, explicit shaming is not going on. But this is a, they called it a public service campaign from a children's hospital in Atlanta that basically said, you know, these people are the victims of awful parents, which is also not true.
Can I interrupt just
a minute?
Sure.
Okay. Chubby kids may not outlive their parents, it says under the warning on the first one. Fat kids become fat adults is the warning on the second one. Big bones didn't make me this way. Big meals did. He has his father's eyes, his laugh, and maybe even his diabetes is the caption on the last one. Well, the thing about these campaigns for awareness is that they are completely useless because people who are living in large bodies know it already. These kids hear it from their peers. They hear it from their parents. And so it's pretty much useless to say, let's drive up the awareness of obesity when you're not doing anything to provide people help for overcoming it. It's like, you know, classical advertising strategy is problem solution. When your ad is all problem, people tune out or feel bad and actually feel quite a bit of despair. And in fact, this study in the International Journal of Obesity pointed out that many of the public health campaigns that we were doing at the time, this study was in 2012, were actually more directed at fighting the people with obesity than fighting the disease itself. Now, that's kind of a bummer. But the truth is that science is bringing us a better understanding of the condition. There's a really clear understanding at this point that the storage of energy is regulated by the same part of the brain that regulates how much oxygen you consume, your body temperature, and so forth. It's all in the hypothalamus. There's communication between the gut and the brain that makes sure that your body maintains a sufficient fat mass for good health. And with that, better therapies are coming. And there's a growing evidence base for treatments like bariatric surgery that can dramatically improve people's health. But the real opportunity to do better than we've been doing, and the ethical lapse here is targeting people instead of targeting the disease, is objectivity to replace the bias, curiosity about the condition, and caring for these people. And with the choir leaving, I'm on my last slide, which is that there are some common threads here in all of these ethical lapses. And what I would say is that the common threads are a bias against a marginalized group, whether that's people who are big or poor African-American sharecroppers or people who drink to excess. There's rationalization to support the bias. Well, they deserve it. I can't tell you in my work how often I hear people saying, you know, these fat people did it to themselves, they deserve what they get. What John Kennedy said in a speech, which I think is really, really a concise statement of things, enjoined the comfort of an opinion without the discomfort of thought. So, if I could leave you with just one message, and I'm happy to take your questions, it would be that ethical mistakes happen, But we really need to be careful about them because they have lasting effects. It just, you can't erase them quickly. Thank you very much. Bobby.
I bought a loaf of wonderful whole wheat preservative-free bread at the market out here for $5.99. If I'm a poor person and I have a limited amount of money to spend on food, I'm probably going to choose the less the poorer nutrition. And certainly, I'm not going to buy fresh fruits and vegetables, which are more expensive.
Right.
So I don't know how much that. And I wonder if there's data that connects income level to obesity.
So, yes, there is. And there are two answers to that. You know, one answer, and I just, right now as we speak, American Society for Nutrition is having their annual meeting in Baltimore, and I just saw a slide from one of the presenters that kind of summed up what you're saying in a really pithy way, and that is that calories are cheap, nutrients are expensive. So, you know, and what that means is that cheap, empty, relatively empty calories are easy to come by. Nutrient-dense foods are not so easy to come by. So that what you're saying is absolutely true, and obesity has affected people with lower socioeconomic status more than it has the rest of the population. They are more at risk. But as the prevalence of obesity has risen, it's risen in parallel. So there were more. It's affecting all levels of socioeconomic status. So you can kind of put yourself into a box if you think that this is just a disease of poor people, because it's something that's affecting everybody. It's affecting folks who are impoverished more. And there's some evidence, and it'd be a long conversation we could have, but there's evidence that the policies that we enact to deal with it are more helpful to wealthier people than they are to impoverished people.
Now, maybe it's just the way you chose these examples, but it seems to me, and I can think of a couple other cases where in the 20s and 30s, the beginning of the 20th century, there seemed to be a flurry of what I would call junk science, on which, you know, a lot of assumptions were based. Obesity goes back that far, but the first three are in that same time period.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
So, scientific rigor and objectivity is really a theme that's in all of this that we talked about, because when you have strong opinions and strong feelings about something, it makes it a lot easier to then rationalize what you want to do anyway. And it happened in Tuskegee, you know, where these investigators, clearly from those records, had strong feelings about the sexual behavior of African Americans, and that helped them rationalize what was really an abusive experiment. Same thing with alcohol. You know, these people who drink are evil, and there's nothing wrong with putting some poison in the alcohol. If they're dumb enough to drink it, they get what they deserve. And it's certainly, we see it over and over again in nutrition research and obesity, where people say, you know, you can't tell me that, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And I could bore you all day with examples of that. Yeah.
You talk about dismissing objective facts, and I think that was addressing that very thing. They don't care, these zealots, about the objective facts. They're
Right.
So when you start to do that, everything falls apart. And you talk about the obesity epidemic. The public health field keeps insisting that we have to work on prevention, and that's the goal. Well, they completely dismiss the facts that people continue to become, more and more people become obese. So I just think this idea of dismissing objective facts is a thread that goes throughout our history, but it seems like it's really prominent right now in all kinds of fields. So how does it affect science? And I realize public health isn't quite the same kind of science as more clinical fields.
Well, last summer, Jim Gilchrist gave a whole seminar on truth decay. And we are so polarized now that there's a tendency to replace, to prioritize what we feel over what the facts tell us. It is an issue for our time, but it's not something that's brand new to human beings. I mean, we are head and heart, and sometimes the head gets ahead of the heart. You could tell me chapter and verse about pietistic movements in the church that have that have created movements within the church that put feeling over theology, and it's a human foible. My suggestion is try and nurture a passion for objectivity. Find virtue in objectivity. And challenge yourself and challenge each other to think about what do we really know? Yeah, John.
It's our point in history, we can look back at eugenics and say that was wrong. However, there's a movement worldwide now for, and I don't know exactly how to describe it, but to affect the genes in reproduction so as to eliminate certain conditions in a newborn,
right,
or to favor certain pathogens.
Right.
Where is that going? And I guess I'm looking for your opinion. Where can the church be in this very, in a way, legitimate scientific inquiry?
I have to admit that I don't feel adequate to answer that. I just know, there's that experiment of gene-edited babies in China that was, viewed as unethical, and the scientists did it nonetheless. And he had a noble purpose that enabled him to rationalize it, but I think the scientific community has uniformly spoken out against that as an unethical movement. How can the church be a voice? I would defer to better experts than I. Maybe somebody on the seminary board might have some ideas about that.
But even if the scientific community now doesn't approve it, it's going to be spread by probably commercially. People with means are going to choose to do that.
Well, I think that's right, but I think that I think ethics is an important consideration that needs to have voice, and you need to have committed people speaking up and saying, no, this is right, this is wrong, and let's distinguish between the two. And I do think that the church is has to be a strong ethical voice in our community, but it doesn't need to be, righteousness versus truth. It needs to be truth and righteousness, right?
Apparently. Yes, a lot of prescribed medications cause weight gain, some very significant.
That's absolutely
right. People respond differently. Some may not gain much weight. And some doctors are sympathetic to listening to this, but a lot of them aren't, and they make the patient feel like they're somehow responsible for what they
think. You are 150% right. 10 years ago, type 2 diabetes was treated largely with drugs that would make patients gain weight. And those drugs, you know, for instance, insulin will make someone gain weight. And so for someone with type 2 diabetes, that has to be prescribed very carefully. And it's being prescribed smarter now than it used to be. And a lot of those drugs that caused weight gain in diabetes have lost favor. But there's patient after patient who can tell you their stories about being prescribed drugs that made them gain weight and then being blamed for gaining the weight.
Some years ago, I was diagnosed by my doctor as obese. I have never been in my own mind obese in my whole life. My problem was somehow the body mass index was wrong, you know. So he didn't have any idea what I should do about my, you know, obesity. But I found that very curious that the doctor would describe me as obese.
Right. Well, that gets back to the, you know, certainly it was easier for you, but that gets back to the problem of telling people they have a problem and offering them no solution. And from being somebody who's done a lot of research on consumer behavior, the consumer response to a situation like that is, if you don't have an answer, it's not a problem. And that's why, you know, about half of the people who have clinically significant obesity will tell you, obese? No, that's not me. And, you know, and the fact behind that is it's a highly stigmatized condition. I'm not one of those people. I could stand to lose a little bit of weight, but I'm not obese. And that's because we treat it more like an identity than a physiologic condition. And we don't offer people solutions. We actually torment them and say, go away and come back when you've lost weight. And in fact, that's what patients do. They go away and get sick with other things, like liver disease.
You mentioned something in the case of alcohol consumption was on the rise in the first 2 decades of the last century. Mm-hmm. Trigger a thought here, having spent a lot of time on quality, we talk a lot about root cause analysis, and that's an iterative process. And you get into trouble, it seems to me that that's what I'm saying here, you get into trouble when you stop and you said, okay, I found the answer without continuing to dig.
Right.
Because a lot of these things have causes that could be addressed. We're really tackling the symptom in a lot of these cases, not looking at the underlying cause.
Right, and the problem with alcohol, you know, was industrialization and urbanization, and those social conditions led to more alcohol abuse, and as you say, without root cause analysis, the answer was deemed to be, let's just prohibit it, and all will be well. But there were these other problems going on that were promoting it. Anybody else? Well, thank you so much. You get 5 minutes back.